This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
And we're back, and we don't have time. We don't have time for Andrew's bullshit today because we have a lot to talk about. We have DHH with us, fresh off of a exciting Rails world. So thanks for coming on and chatting with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris, lob it up. Softball, let's go.
I was going to say, how do you feel the first Rails world went?
It was incredible. Well, it was funny. I was going to say anyone who was there in person could feel the energy, but I'm pretty sure the energy was felt even by the people who were not there in person, which is always the hallmark, I think, of a nice gathering when the people who were not even there go, that looked like some fun. And I think it was a ton of fun. It was a ton of good energy. There was something in the air, I think, partly because Amanda, the executive director of the Rails Foundation, just did an absolutely stellar job creating the venue for it. It's funny because I kept seeing all the invoices come into the foundation's account, just like this thing and that thing. And really, is all this needed to create a conference? And then you show up in person and you go, oh, this is why we did it this way. This is why it costs so much to put on, but it was so worth it. I mean, for me personally, too, I hadn't done a lot of tech conferences in quite a long time. I mean, from before the pandemic in person, I'd done a few entrepreneurial conferences in Europe after the pandemic, but there was just nothing like seeing a bunch of programmers together being super duper excited about all sorts of new stuff. I think that kind of human connection that you can create and really only create when you're in person was just, it was just such a breath of fresh air. I mean, I think perhaps for everyone, but especially for me, there's just been sort of over many years where the main interaction with the ecosystem and the community is through social media or other online aspects that have this at times, I was about to say interesting tone, but that's a euphemism for shitty tone. And then you show up in person and there's just a bunch of people who are really excited about building the same kind of stuff that you build. And they also actually like Ruby and they all these things. And you just go like, yeah, this is great. So in whole, I'd say this went far beyond my expectations. I had pretty high expectations for it. I mean, we sold out so quickly. So I thought, well, first of all, there's really a lot of latent interest here for something different, something in Europe, something from a new organization. But you never know until you show up to the party, whether it's going to be a good party or not. But it was an amazing party.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, was it over half the crowd or something? It was like their first Rails conference or something when that was asked. I was kind of amazed.
That is something I was really glad to see. I think always you should have an eye to whether your ecosystem and community is getting fresh blood. I mean, there's a bunch of people who've been doing Ruby on Rails for 5 years, for 10 years, and in some cases for 20 years. And that's great. It's wonderful to have that expertise and have that history and so on. But if you don't manage to attract new people into the ecosystem, you are slowly dying. That is just the matter of fact. And I think to see that at Rails World, so many new people who either had discovered just Rails on their own or started a job where they needed it or were looking for a job where they needed it, it was really heartwarming to see. And I think this is exactly what we were setting up the foundation to do. I mean, it was not just as important and as nice as it was to have a party for people already in the ecosystem and community. The Rails Foundation's mission is to attract new people to the community such that the core members, the Shopify's, GitHub's and 37 Signals and all the rest of them have someone to hire 5 years from now, 10 years from now. We won't have that unless we attract new people. So that is just right in line with the mission. This was one of the sort of focal points of what we're doing. We're going to do events and then we're going to do documentation. We're going to do education and we're going to do marketing as a broad discipline of attracting more people and getting people excited about it. I think this was the other thing, that there was just a real excitement in the air, both from the new people, from the people who had already been there, and from the people who had been building a bunch of new stuff that got to be presented here at the same time. It felt like there were about five different threads that all came together right around the same time, bunch of new releases, all this excitement about the foundation and Rails World. And somehow that just happened in this one 2-day span, that it could all come together at the same time. I don't think we could have planned it that well, even if we tried.
I really like what you said about the foundation, like also from the sponsor side, like Shopify, like they're investing so that they're also creating a future for themselves to hire people, because that is something like I've noticed in the last, I don't know, like 5 years, marketing's become really key part of open source. And so I'm really excited to see the foundation helping drive that forward.
And this was really my pitch when I went to Shopify and GitHub and the rest of them. Do you know what? I could give you a pitch about altruism right now. You should give back. This is just good for karma. But do you know what's an easier sell? This is good for you right here, right now. This is good for you as a business. This is not a charity expense. This is a business expense. You're investing in your future capacity to hire people. Would you like to be an ongoing concern in 5, 10, 20 years? If so, you should care about that pipeline of new talent coming in. Therefore, it is directly in your personal interest to do this. And I think this is also one of the things that sets the Rails Foundation apart is it is overtly commercial. It is overtly commercial in its setup, in its fundraising goals, in its benefactors. There's all these very nice side effects for the ecosystem at large, but it is intentionally constructed as a business association. Here's 8 companies coming together and going, you know what? We're going to pool together, get $1 million raised and a budget going forward to solve some of our shared problems. It's literally in the charter for these kinds of business associations. It's not a hobbyist, charity, whatever thing. Now, those things are great too. And we have a lot of them, those things in open source. And I think it's wonderful. But I think it's also wonderful to realize that business is not the enemy. I think perhaps more so in Ruby on Rails than other communities, there's an appreciation that this is tooling for business. We're here to service entrepreneurship. We're here to service the businesses that are on it. This is not sort of a fight between those two things. And I think part of that becomes easier when we then also don't have a Rails Inc. There's not a company that is trying to capture as much of the value of the ecosystem as possible and push out all these other folks who are trying to build on top of the platform of Rails. No, there's a business association now with the Rails Foundation that sees a direct interest in sort of pushing this forward and getting the documentation better, getting the education lifted up, producing wonderful events, and that can coexist with the rest of it. This is when I have such, I was about to say mixed, nuanced, whatever, divergent feelings about commercial open source. I don't want to commercialize my own involvement. And it sounds just saying on the one hand, like I love the commercialization, I love all these things. Yes, in the spirit of this shared commons, I'm not trying to get the Rails Inc. thing going. I'm not trying to become Vercel or any of these other things. I actually think that Rails community is special in part because it doesn't have that dominance. There's room for a ton of different companies to come in and do things, contribute in the ecosystem without thinking, do you know what? 5 minutes from now, there's a huge whale swimming right over there and it's going to eat me. If I build on top of this, it's going to eat me. That's not how we do things here. So anyway, I think it's a good setup and it's a good setup where we're honest about what we're here for. The Rails Foundation is upfront and clear what it's for. I had some folks at Rails World come up and say, hey, how can we donate to the Rails Foundation? Like just as individuals. And I think that's really nice to hear. I love the people, but please keep your money in your pocket. It sets up wrong expectations about what this is. And also, do you know what? It's a pittance and we don't need a pittance. We need $1 million. And we should ask the kind of companies who have $1 million to put into it.
I mean, that's really good because you don't have the potential of, you know, if Rails was some company, then maybe it gets sold or acquired or gets into financial trouble and all that. Like it just adds another layer of complexity too. And then maybe that company raises money and now they got to deal with investors and their goals and whatever else. Like we have a nice clean slate that everything here is kind of just sort of like you were saying in one of your recent podcasts, it's gifts. These are just things we've given you. We've taken it. We didn't have to, but no strings attached. Here you go. Use it as you want. And I think that's
really
nice.
And I'd really like to keep it at that level, that what we do here is gift exchange. Gift exchange where we recognize that the gifts are being made by individuals and companies who see a self-interest in creating those gifts. they're not just sort of completely altruistic. I'm not just doing it for other people. Like almost every bit of open source I've ever done, I've done for myself first. And that maybe rings weird in some people's ears. And there are other motivations that others can have for open source, that they're doing it selfishly and in service of others. I totally respect that. It's wonderful for that to be true. But this is why I'm doing it. I'm making it for me. And then I'm going like, I made it for me anyway. So let me just pass the gift on.
Yeah. And then in turn, you get other people with wonderful ideas who come in and can help push it forward. And then it helps people like me who don't do open source, just ride the waves of everyone else. So,
yeah, I've done on our PayGem that we maintain, built that for myself to abstract payments between, I wanted to use Stripe, but they don't support PayPal. So we have Braintree integration that we kind of mask and pretend that it works like Stripe. But now I'm maintaining, we accepted a PR to do Paddle support in there. I don't use Paddle, but now I have to go learn Paddle and invest a bunch of time on something I don't use, which can be very frustrating. You can start easily feeling resentful. Working on the project, you're like, oh, I don't want to do this because I don't use it and I don't care and I have to maintain it or whatever. And it's nice to be like, here's what we've made for ourselves, and we're going to maintain that, and we're going to share that, and people can add on to it. But what we've built is started primarily for ourselves, and I think it's much easier to say it's going to continue that way because these are the things that we need. But as you see GitHub contributing the multi-database support and a lot of those things, it's like, well, GitHub's part of the community. They maintain those things and work on them and contribute that. We all benefit from it. But each piece can kind of be maintained by people who care about that problem or whatever, which I think is awesome.
And I think it's exactly the antidote to this notion that open source is primarily about unpaid labor. I can totally see how you get to the unpaid labor, in my opinion, dead end. If you go, I don't need this stuff, I'm just doing it for other people. And now you have a bunch of companies, especially when companies come in, they're like, oh, we like this thing, can you build it for us? And you go like, well, I'm not going to use it. I'm just building it for you. You would otherwise have had to build it. So what am I, just an unpaid employee? I think that is why it's so important to keep that boundary. And it's one I've tried to establish right from the get-go. That infamous fuck you slide was about this. It was exactly about this. If you're coming to me and say, the actual anecdote that slide is based on was someone coming to me and saying, hey, unless you build an Oracle adapter for Active Record, Rails is never going to be taken seriously because Oracle dominates the database world. You should build it. I don't care whether you use Oracle or not. It's your obligation to make sure that Rails works with Oracle. And I'm like, no. And not just no, fuck no. I'm not going to build your damn Oracle adapter for you because you think that that's in the service of Rails. If you need an Oracle adapter, build it yourself. By the way, someone did. And maintained it and do a very nice job of it. And that's the gift exchange that I'm here for, right? You show up with an Oracle adapter that doesn't require me to learn everything about Oracle. Wonderful. We're sharing gifts. I love it. You come up telling me that I need to build an Oracle adapter for you free of charge just because you think so. No, you're going to get the slide. And I think, again, having that sense that we're self-interested individuals, beings, we can also have altruism as part of our sort of catalog of capacities. But first and foremost, the easy path, the smooth path is to get self-interested individuals to show up and collaborate in their own interest. This is the magic of commerce. This is the magic of free markets, capitalism, the whole lot of it. And we can put that to work within an open source context where there's no monetary obligations, where there's no exchange of goods for something. I'm not selling you something. This is why I've been so adamant that Rails shouldn't have an ink, that there shouldn't be something that you buy from Rails or me or the core group or something else like that, because then you enter into the vendor relationship. If you're paying for something, it's completely reasonable to go, well, I expect it to do A, B, C, D, and E, and F. Versus if I'm giving you a gift, it's so much easier for me to say, do you know what? I love it if you love it. I also love it if you don't love it, and I don't give a damn if you hate it. It doesn't matter to some extent. Now, again, I like for my gifts to be widely used. There's a satisfaction in simply seeing your work being employed in a bunch of places. But I think that comes naturally and easily when people are just making good stuff for themselves. I think that's the other thing of it. There's sort of a quality aspect to this where I find that people who work on their own problems tend to do it better. That's not to say that you can't do good work on other people's problems. You absolutely can. It's just much harder. It's a longer route. When you're capable of individually assessing the quality of your solution because you're addressing your own problem, you can at very least move faster. And I also think a lot of the times you move better. So I think this is why I'm so hung up on this thing about extraction, that Rails is an extracted framework. It's not an invented framework. We don't go out looking for imaginary problems or other people's problems even, and then try to come up with solutions to that. No, we look at our own problems. Then we do come up to solutions for that. And if those solutions are good and general and generic, we extract them, put them into the framework, and share them with all.
And I think that's a awesome segue into some of the stuff you've got cooking right now. We just had Rails World. There's a keynote we'll link to in the show notes where you talk about 7-8 different things that are coming out. And mostly I assume those are coming out of Hay and Basecamp, like real world problems. So I'd love to kind of hear, I don't know, maybe start with one you're most excited about right now, if you can pick.
Oh, yes. Yes. So it was actually kind of crazy putting it all together because I was thinking like any one of those 7 frameworks, and I even didn't include all of them. I had an 8th thing cooking and I was like, you know what? There's already too much. I can't put everything in here. And now there's a 9th thing. But just out of, we're going to have to treat it at a high level because we got to move quickly and just showing all this stuff. But if we just take one thing that I've just ducked back into after doing the initial work about a year and a half ago is PropShaft. I really like PropShaft. And it's not because it's solving a novel problem to some extent. It's actually almost the opposite. It is showing that over time, when the fundamentals of the web improve, we can wind back the clock on our own solutions, that we can take some of the complexity out that we used to have to deal with ourselves and flush it. So PropShaft is this kind of boiling down the essence of what is Sprockets. What was it trying to do? What should it do in 2023 when it doesn't have to deal with a bunch of these other concerns that were jammed into it? I also like PropShaft because it's a clean sheet of paper. I really like the idea that occasionally you pull a completely clean sheet of paper, you don't start from something else, and you go, with everything I know today, right now, what would I build if I had free reins? I think this is why a lot of developers like Greenfield. This is why Greenfield is exciting, because you feel like, well, I at least feel like when I do Greenfield development, I can show up and I can use the maximum capacity of what I'm capable of. When I'm working on an old app that's maybe 5, 7, 10 years old, I'm constrained by 5, 7, 10 year old thinking of solutions. And I often know that I'm capable of more, the technology is capable of more, but I just, for whatever reason, can't do it. PropShaft is that clean sheet of paper. What are we capable of in terms of simplicity of solving this quite important problem now? So it's really been a blast. It's in fact, so I've been diving into it recently. I'm working on this other thing. I got really annoyed with build phases in general, and that just spilled into all the things. And then I had to change one line on the basecamp.com website. And we had a, I think it's Jekyll or something else. We had a build pipeline set up. And between the deployment and some of it was because our Git repo was overstuffed with some big files and whatever. There were a lot of factors. I'm not putting it all on Jekyll at all here. I'm just saying for us in our experience here, it took almost 20 minutes to deploy. 20 minutes between having to go to a staging server first and then having to go to the production server. And all I wanted to do was change one line. That's not reasonable. It is not reasonable to spend 20 minutes to change one line. And I went like, do you know what? Is this just an us problem? Is this a specific problem? And I'm like, no, it's not. We're using preferred way, the built way of doing things. And I go, do you know what? This sucks. And it sucks more than FTP used to do back in like 99. FTP had better developer ergonomics than 2023 full build pipeline set up, whatever out the wazoo. Like, that's not reasonable. Now, FTP, of course, had issues. And if you're not running version controls, I can't have been the only person who overwrote actual production files with a wrong FTP drop. So it's not like we fully want to go back to the past and all of its foibles, but we should always be looking to the past and go, did we make things better? And in which ways did we make them better? And in which ways did we make it worse? Can we get rid of the ways we made it worse and just keep the ways we made it better? That is something I'm super excited about. And PropShaft has all of these qualities. It touches on all of this. And I'm excited to wrap it up because I kind of felt like we built, or I started Prop Shaft, and then I got Bruno involved in sort of shaping and finishing it. And then we put it into production with Hay about, what I don't know, 2 years ago or shortly thereafter. And then I kind of haven't done the last mile to be able to, all right, let's, there's some issues if you do fully nested dependencies, especially if you're doing a React style setup and so on. There's a little bit we still have to figure out, but I want to solve it and I want to finish it and I want to make it the default. So that to me is often the journey is we'll make a spike. We'll validate the spike within production applications. Then we'll extract it out. And then the final step is if we're going to have an impact on a lot of people and be in service of a lot of people, it's got to move to the default. So this is what a lot of these projects are in various stages of, from initial concept to validation in a production app to extraction into a nicely polished library or framework to the final step of becoming a default.
Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, Honeybadger. If you're like most developers, too much of your time gets sucked up with downtime issues, troubleshooting, and error tracking. How can you spend more time shipping code and less time putting out fires? Honeybadger's how. It's a suite of monitoring tools specifically for developers. It's the only system that combines error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron and heartbeat monitoring into a clean, fast interface. Sure, you can get familiar with any interface, but why waste your time learning some Frankensystem interface that looks like an airline cockpit when what you really need is clarity and speed? You won't know if Honeybadger will really save you time and trouble until you see how it works in your own toolchain. With two lines of code in 5 minutes, you can see for yourself. Honeybadger automatically hooks into popular web frameworks, job systems, authentication libraries, and your front-end JavaScript. Imagine fixing errors before your users can even report them. That is a wonderful way to delight your customers. 5 minutes of your time with a free trial is all it takes to see if it will work for you. Just might be the best 5 minutes you've spent in a while. Check out honeybadger.io.
For the sake of time, I'll ask you quickly, do you have any more to share about the static site stuff you're thinking about?
So just before jumping on here, working on it because I'm just like, now I'm annoyed, right? I'm like, do you know what? No, 20 minutes. No, I want 2 seconds. I want 3 second deploys. I want change one line of code, instantly refresh in production and it's live. So I've been working on this thing, building on top of Kamal, which I haven't fully cleared the trademark space search. So perhaps given recent experiences in that domain, I shouldn't commit myself too hard to the name, but right now it's called Skiff. As a small boat, sort of playing on these things, Skiff, S-K-I-F-F. So I'm working on Skiff, and Skiff is an idea of using Kamal as a way to bootstrap this deploy, then utilizing server-side includes as the sort of most basic way of creating static sites in HTML without replicating all the XML, still being able to have layouts. That was the thing. So I looked through both the Basecamp.com marketing site we have and Hay.com marketing site, and we're using Jekyll. I think on both of them. On some of the other ones, we're using some JavaScript thingy, but they're the same thing, right? Like a bunch of templates and setup and you do a build phase. And I was like, what are we using? What is the main value we're getting out of it? And the main value is layouts. The main value is that you can have sort of a reusable layout so you're not duplicating all the common stuff all over. And if you have to change, you've got to change in 50 files. Server-side includes was the solution to that problem. And I think like it's from like literally 97 or 96. And it hasn't been used a ton since, but Nginx has support for it. I'm just working through the last bits of that. So I'm working on that because I want to solve my own problem. Is it going to be the full solution? I actually just hit a snag. I thought I was like, had a clear shot here. And then it turns out that Nginx, when you use server-side includes, does not want to generate dynamic e-tags for it. And I'm like, I got to figure that out. Like, I'm not giving up my e-tags here. I want to have as good caching dynamics as you would have on anything else. So still got to solve that out. But let's see if we get there. It's going to be a Kamal-like thing. It's not actually going to be tied to Rails. This was just another thing I was excited about solving, reaching into the past. What can we learn from the past? Oh, SSI. I remember using that in the 90s. That's a blast from the past. Can we then solve some of those modern problems where we're not dealing with pet servers? Oh, Kamal is actually a way of dealing that. You just feed it an IP address and you can run Kamal setup and boom, you're live and we can use Docker and all of these other things. That invigorates me. I love this sense of we're learning from the past, but we're not living in the past. We're not ludits. We're not against progress. We don't want to just give up on the intrinsic advances in technology. There's a lot of accidental stuff that comes with it, right? This is what I talked about at the beginning of my keynote. This whole sense of we wanted to write modern JavaScript. We wanted better build pipelines. Those were all noble, good goals. And then all the build phase stuff was just kind of what we had to do to get there. And then as soon as we can remove that scaffolding, awesome. Let's actually set fire to it and cheer at the burning rage that goes up from that, right? Like that's the fun of it. And I think that's the fun of it is why still do it. This is what gets me up in the morning. Like I want to feel like it matters whether I'm here or not. It matters whether we're here or not. It matters whether we're engaging with these problems in a way where we're moving forward. So anyway, that's a really long way of saying I'm very excited for this GIF thing. It may not actually work. This is also one of these other things. Don't be so attached to your ideas. I just had an idea like a few days ago, like, ooh, I wonder if we can get rid of digested file names. Those are really actually annoying. It's 80% of the prop chef code. Was there a way we can boil it down to 20%? And I went on this huge deep dive into HTTP caching dynamics. And it was like, maybe we can use the base tag, which is a really interesting tag that also hasn't seen use. And it's also one of those like 90s tags that people haven't used in a long time. Then unfortunately, if you combine a base tag, that's where you could put your asset hash in there, then it actually gives all of the ACID links unique URLs and then you lose your caching again. So just this constant battle where you're trying to like be excited about a new idea, but not be so wedded to it that you're going to follow it to its death. If it doesn't work, you give up and you move on.
That really nicely leads into a question that I've definitely thought of and a bunch of other people have asked too, which is, I think as Rails developers, we tend to grab stuff off the shelf, but I know that the way you approach problems and 37 signals in general tends to be looking at the problem itself, the solutions that are out there, and often starting to build your own solution from scratch based on those learnings. And I think you're talking about that process right there, but I wanted to just put that out there and ask, like, when do we use something that already exists, that a background worker system or something that's tried and true and thousands of applications versus building your own? How do you make those decisions?
That's a great point. And it goes to the origins of Ruby on Rails. Like when I got started with Rails, there are a bunch of other solutions to make websites and web applications with. I didn't have to pick this at the time exotic programming language Ruby. I could just have done PHP or ASP.NET or Java or a bunch of other things. And I would have, if those things would have given me the same joy as Ruby did. I mean, I'm not like in the game of building things just for the sake of building them. I'm in the game of building things when I feel like I can do better than what is. And I think perhaps the difference here is exactly, I do try to approach most of the domains that we deal with on an intimate basis. That is, it's sort of intrinsic to how we build. It dictates how we can build from a first principles approach. If there's something else that exists out there, let me give another example. I've never had the inclination to build an HTTP server. So we use Puma. Puma is the default in Rails. It's great. I wish Puma did HTTP 2 out of the box. But other than that, I don't have a lot of complaints. I certainly don't have any complaints to the level of, oh, let's just go off and build an HTTP server because maybe that would be fun. That's not a problem that impacts me on a daily basis. Again, except for the HTTP 2, I hope we find a solution for that. And there are other ways we can get about it. And that's a whole discussion on its own. But it's an example of a domain that, you know what? I don't need to deal with that. Job running is different. And it's different in part because it's something we use for all of our apps. It's an integral part of running something like Hey or Basecamp. We're actually trying to find out how many jobs a day do we execute for Basecamp. And it's like tens of millions of jobs, right? And that's at our scale. If you look at a Shopify or something, I mean, sure, there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of jobs every day. It's a really integral part of how you work. And it impacts how you program because it impacts what do you put into, what do you delay? What do you move out of the main thread? There's a lot of impact into how the application feels and how that process feels. So already there, I care about it at a different level than I do an implementation of a spec that just is, right? HTTP is just a spec and that it is what it is. Job running is not a spec. To some extent, perhaps we're trying to make it a spec, at least in the Rails world. That's where the actual job is, that we can have multiple backends. But we had used Rescue for a very long time, I think probably 10 years. And we had just run into a bunch of areas where it needed extension, it needed patching. It was kind of like a old charming house. Like you look at it, like, yeah, it's really charming, but the roof kind of leaks and you got to be careful not to step on that stone because it's a little loose and the door upstairs is a little scratchy. And do you know what? It has more charm when it's a house than when it's a piece of software that feels like that. It just felt creaky. And it was evidenced by the fact that I think we have, I said six at the Rails World keynote. It was actually seven. I couldn't even count the number of gems we had on the line. There's seven different gem dependencies that relate to how we run Rescue because we've had to extend it and so on in various ways. That to me right there is just a smell. Do you know what? This is a hodgepodge of stuff. And I always think if I was to start tomorrow and I did not have all this domain knowledge top of mind, how far would I be from like the best? I'd be quite far. If I just start tomorrow and just put in the Rescue thing, I'm going to fall into all the pitfalls that we have seven gems to ameliorate, right? I don't want to keep that in working memory. I don't want to have that as a barrier for me as the one person framework user having to learn all of this stuff, right? Like this should just work. So that's when we started looking into the alternatives. And as I said at the keynote, some things just off the bat weren't going to be relevant for us. We were not going to buy commercial software to solve this problem. So Sidekick was out. And then The Late Job had some of the same creaky house dynamics as Rescue did. And then Good Job was a really good example of something that was written as a clean slate. It was written for our active job right out of the gate and so on. There's a lot of good things to like about it, but it was written in for Postgres. We didn't use Postgres. We used MySQL. And we had a deep dive into the implementation and found it difficult to extend in those ways. Like we were going to make it generic for MySQL. It was like, do you know what? That didn't seem like an easy path to do. It wasn't just like, oh yeah, I'll just slot it right in here and then we're good to go. So that led us to this sense of, you know what? Again, for the sake of the argument, let's just pull off a clean sheet of paper. Let's give it a cycle. Let's see if Rosa, who's the programmer at 37 Signals working on this problem, let's see what Rosa can come up with in a cycle. And maybe we'll go after that spike, do you know what? It's too much work. We don't like it. We can't find the right dynamics. But we didn't. We worked on it for a cycle and it was more or less ready in prototype form to start handling some jobs. And we went like, yeah, do you know what? This is good. This is better. This solves our problem. This is not so difficult to be beyond our comprehension or capacity to build it. We should just build it. This is the other thing I think a lot of people perhaps don't understand. It's like when we choose to build, say, a new framework or a new library, we don't throw like 20 programmers at it. This is not how it works at 37 Signals. There's like literally one person who will work on it mostly part-time to get it where it needs to be. So I look at that investment and go, do you know what? If we can somehow distill, whatever, 12, 13 years of learnings, running job queues, building all these patches to Rescue into a beautiful clean sheet implementation that is easy for others to understand and extend and solve our problem exactly, is free and open source, works with MySQL, and we potentially ship it such that next time I start a Rails application, I can wipe all of that arcane knowledge about job running, queuing, setting up from my memory, and it just freaking works. That's worthwhile. That's worth doing. And it won't be the same in every case. And there are other cases where you look at the solutions or other solutions and you go, you know what? This is totally fine. Not only is it fine, it's great. Let's just use it. I'm not investing as we are actually, and this is where the commercial aspect comes in. When we assign someone like Rosa to work on this problem, like that's pretty expensive. You just go whatever the monthly run rate of lead programmer at 37 Signals salaries and benefits and whatever is. That's a serious investment into moving things forward. We don't take that willy-nilly. I don't do it just for the sport of it. I sometimes do things myself for the sport of it, but that's anything where we go like, all right, we're going to assign a programmer at 37 Signals who's not then going to work on some other business problems to move things business-wise forward. It's got to be worth it. And it felt like it was worth it with this. It definitely felt like it was worth it for solid cash as well. This was coming on with some of these ideas of when the fundamentals change, how do we question what we do? I love that. I love those moments where you go like, hey, here's two orders of magnitude. Two orders of magnitude change in the speed of storage. That's got to stretch some premises. There's no way we would build everything the same way if we had two orders of magnitude better performance. So it's the same thing like import maps, right? Ooh, import maps. I remember when I first stumbled across that, I was like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what you could do with that. I wonder what you could take out. I wonder what you could tinkle with. It is one of those things that feels like storage advancing two orders of magnitude in performance, the introduction of import maps, ES6 being straight into browsers, all of this stuff moving forward. Let's revisit our priors. What do we know now? That's no longer so.
And you also earlier you mentioned taking it and burning it and celebrating. That was me with Webpacker when we came into CSS bundling, JS bundling.
Yeah, that one, it was a unique one. As I mentioned at RailsWorld, I knew that. I knew this was like Burning Man statue that I couldn't wait to torch right from the get-go, right? And the only reason I kind of dedicated myself to work on it was it had even more that dynamic of, do you know what? I don't want to have this in working memory. I don't want to have the arcane knowledge of what it takes to set up and debug and whatever address, because it falls out of working memory so quickly. This was what motivated me to look into these other things. Literally, it was the anger of not even being able to fully use Webpacker myself because some of the domain knowledge had slipped out of my working memory and just being frustrated for an hour and a half about trying to solve something. I thought like, this should be simple. Why is it not simple? I freaking built this wrapper. I should have been able to understand it. But like in a few short months or a year and a half, like it had already drifted from memory. And now I'm back to square one. And like, how does anyone understand anything? Or do they just waste copious amounts of time? And they probably waste copious amounts of time. That's always a good sort of smell test for me. I'm like, you know what? We need some radical change here.
Yeah, I feel like it goes back to what we were talking about a little bit, where Sprockets and Webpacker and everything were like, let's take on the burden of understanding this stuff. And then JS bundling and CSS bundling is like, what if we don't care? What if you figure it out? We'll do some basic things and get you set up, but you can figure it out and do whatever complicated things you want, or keep it really simple if you would like. But it's a nice middle ground of, we recognize we took on too much responsibility and now we're going to shift that and give it back to you, give you some freedom, but here's this simple interface like ActiveJob as well, where it's like you can dig in real deep into using specific features that Sidekick supports or Rescue or whatever. But if we give you ActiveJob, now you can interchange these backends however you would like. And I think I was talking to John Nunemaker about using like feature flags to actually test running two different background jobs at the same time and just saying, let's just turn on this backend for these jobs and whatever, and we can migrate away. And I thought that was really interesting. But it's finding the right abstraction layer, I think, is yes, definitely one of those things that is maybe a constant battle, just never quite win. Right now, it's good boundary, but in 5 years, not the same boundary anymore or whatever.
Totally. You got to be flexible in your positions. Strong opinions, loosely held, is a motto I very much ascribe to. I have a lot of strong opinions, and I try to hold them as loosely as I can. That is, if new evidence, progress emerges, I will absolutely change my mind, because otherwise we get stuck. And you know what? That's also just no fun. I can't do this for 20 years, just doing the same things over and over again. Got to move with the progress. We got to move with the times. We got to move with the insights. Sometimes the insights are something that could have been done 10 years ago and no one just found the exact right angle for it. But then they did and went like, oh yeah, in retrospect now, that's obvious. What's interesting about the Webpacker thing was that I think I'd do the same again. I don't regret the Webpacker phase, because when Webpacker was first integrated with Rails, we didn't have ES Build. We didn't have Bun. We didn't have the sort of command line tool, ease of use dynamics for it. Webpack was legitimately the main show, was the best game in the game for a while. And then as things move forward, especially I think ES Build for me was one of those things where like, yes, I love that. Talk about a clean sheet of paper. Talk about fundamental improvement and advancement. I mean, holy smokes. Poked mild fun at it in terms of no build versus this, but the achievement is monumental. I mean, it's very rare we see something like this where someone re-implements something from scratch and it's literally 80 times faster than the predominant things people were doing like 2 years ago. That is worthy of immense applaud. So the whole JS bundling Rails and CSS bundling Rails was kind of like trying to pay homage to that. Someone made fundamental improvement. Let's get on the wagon. I feel the same way about Bun, right? Like Rails rushed to support it. There's some fundamental improvement here. Bun is taking the ES Build ideas even further, going in the opposite direction of what's normally happening in JavaScript land, which is exploding every tool into 5,000 different little pieces that you have to put together yourself. They go, no, actually, what if we made one tool that had even more in it, right? And I go, you know what? Yeah, I like this direction. Let's support that. While at the same time going, by default, I'd rather not build at all. And I think no build is the correct default for most people getting into Rails. Now, if you're fully on the React train or Vue train or any of these other things, wonderful. That's great. I'm happy for you. I spent a lot of time doing the work for JS Bundling Rails and CSS Bundling Rails. And this is one of those things I knew I was only going to use it as a transition. We're using both of those tools in Basecamp right now because we had stuff built for Webpack and this was a nice slot in. But then for Hey, we went full no build on the JavaScript side. And then for this new thing we're working on with once.com, we went full no build for both JavaScript and CSS, which means no build at all of any kind, right? Like that's my personal final destination. But I'm also happy to work on some of these things along the way and push up the big tent and go, you know what? Let's have some great solutions for people who do enjoy more of the JavaScript, whatever world. We can totally coexist and I can be happy for you. And we can then work together on some of these other problems. PropShaft, for example, works wonderfully with both a no-build approach and a JS building bundling Rails approach.
Since we only got a few minutes left, I thought I'd throw one common question I keep seeing, which is how do you envision the maintenance of these separate frameworks? Because Hotwire kind of lives outside of Rails, but it's a built-in thing to Rails. Kamal is kind of the same thing. Will you have a separate maintainer team for that? Or how are you thinking about that? And also, I know that people have been asking about, like, can we get regular Rails releases as well? Just kind of the waiting for the new stuff to ship. Like we see it and see blog posts about, oh, there's normalizes and these other cool features in Rails. When do I get to use it? I think is another common question.
Let me start from the last one first. Yes, when the Rails core team met at Rails World, this was one of the points of topic. And we loosely agreed on the fact that we should have a release cadence going forward that is more regular and that the cadence should be about 6 months. So minor releases should be hitting every 6 months. When I look at the Rails 7.1 release, that should have been 7.4. We should have done 3 minor releases in that time to get there. And then we will do the major releases when there's something that fundamentally changes the approach to how you're building it. But we're going to try. And I don't want to put that on a specific cadence, like the major releases, because I want that to be sort of a celebration of something. Rails 7, boom, Hotwire's in by default, import map is in by default. That was a major change. That shouldn't happen in like a 6.2, right? That was not a good fit for a 6.2.
Like the, wasn't jQuery or something added in point release, I remember back in the day, and it was like, this is kind of felt like more of a major release.
Exactly. So we got to divide it up a little bit. And the major releases should happen when there's something major. But there's something happening every week with Rails. Like this week in Rails, the newsletter is covering, I'm off in shock. I'll get the newsletter. I'm like, holy smokes. This was like 1 week's worth of changes and additions and fixes and whatever. And we should do a better job at getting all of those things in the hands of people quicker. Now, on the other end of it, I like to think of it as almost like Nintendo does with its studios. There's first party, that's like Super Mario and Zelda and so on. Then there's second party, which was things like Rare and so on, where they have a direct relationship. And then there's third party, which is built on the platform, but there's no direct relation. Second party stuff for me is stuff like Credis, for example. It lives in the Rails repo, but it's not part of Rails. And therefore, there's quite a close association. It's usually also a default in the gem file. That's kind of tight. And then you have things that sort of straddle the line. Kamal, for me, is third party. Like, it's a tool that I think we should be recommending to people. But you know what? There's a bunch of ways to deploy things. If you're using Heroku, for example, or Fly, they have their own things. You don't need Kamal for that. So it's like associated with, should be recommended when people want to use their own VMs and so on, but it doesn't need to be whatever the default means in that context. It doesn't need to be shoved in. Maybe there's a recommendation or a pointer or something else like that. Hotwire is more like a 2.5 party. Like it's kind of second party in the sense that it is on by default, but the main maintenance and development on it is happening within 37 signals. And then there's also a considerable ecosystem around Hotwire of other people outside the company who are also working on it. And we have taken some, there's a contributors Basecamp, for example, that some folks in the Hotwire community is part of. I'd like to formalize that a little more, but I'm also respectful of the fact that Hotwire is not the same as Rails. Rails, and I say this with love, is enormous. It's enormous in its footprint. It's enormous in its legacy. It's enormous in its features and it's enormous in its number of frameworks, whatever. It's enormous in its aspirations and ambitions. Hotwire is more modest, which is actually one of the funny things. That's usually not a word I use about my projects, but we literally put it as part of the tagline, I believe, for Stimulus, a modest web framework for the HTML you already have or something like that. And Stimulus is a great example. Stimulus is like mostly done. Like it's not seeing a ton of continued evolution. That's not to say there couldn't be things we could add to and so on. But like you couldn't do it this week in Stimulus, right? Like that would be a really boring newsletter because there's just not that much happening. Now, Turbo is a little different. I do hope that Turbo can get closer to the Stimulus end of the churn spectrum than it is to the Rails end of churn spectrum. That at some point we arrive at things that are so good that we don't need as much movement, and then other people can build on top of that. And that's what I'm so thrilled to see in the Hotwire community. A lot of people have built all sorts of stuff on top of it. Stuff that sometimes I think, oh, that's awesome. That's interesting. We might use that. And other times stuff that's like, okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't use that, but I really like that someone could build that on top of Hotwire and get good mileage out of that. I want Hotwire to be that kind of platform because it also frees Hotwire from trying to address everyone's interest in different directions, that it could be a little bit of a lower level baseline that people can build on top of. And then a bunch of this other further development can happen in other projects on top of it. So there's not one clear cut answer for it. I recognize that with Hotwire, especially with the TypeScript drama, there's like whenever that happens, people go like, well, what about governance? What about these things? It's not like those are illegitimate questions. Totally fair. But also, I mean, let's circle back to the gift analogy here, right? We spend literally 10 years and millions building Hotwire, like in all its iterations, getting to this point from Turbo Links to Turbo to all this stuff. And we have put in the vast, vast majority of work into these frameworks and pushing them forward. Strata was a huge thing that consumed tons of people inside the company. I think when Jay pushed it out, he was touching like 13 different repos to update all things and whatever. It's a lot of work and we do it because we need it. So we're solving our own problems first and then we share the gifts. And then those gifts are out there and there are people who want to bring their own gifts and awesome, excellent. And then sometimes there are like discussions, as there always was, and there was more so with Rails in the early days, like which direction should this take? Where should Hotwire go? Should it reach for this? Should it reach for that? We had a lot of discussions in the early Rails days about what is Rails? Where should it go and so on? We don't have as many of those discussions now because that's kind of settled. With Hotwire, it's a little less settled. So I think people perhaps at times mistake it from being more open than it is. And I say that with love, as in, I love the contributions. I love the whatever. It doesn't mean that because someone built something on top of Hotwire, that that's going to go into core, so to speak. And Rails has the same thing. If you look at the number of gems and view components and this, that, and the other things, ideas that exist in the Rails community, a lot of people are excited about. It doesn't mean they end up in the core framework in exactly the same way as someone who's excited about that wants it to happen. That's not a bug in my mind. That's a feature. We have a platform. We work with languages like Ruby, where we literally get to extend them as we see fit. JavaScript is much the same way. You can build on top of Rails and make it feel native to Rails. You can build on top of Hotwire and make it feel native to Hotwire. Doesn't mean it's going to pull it all in. But this is how it should be. There should be people going like, oh, I want to pull it over here. And they pull and they make arguments and blog posts and code and whatever. Sometimes that argument wins. And then other times they go, well, I love that you're doing it. All the best. I'm over here doing this other thing. And that's cool too.
Good answer. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. It's one of those two that's not fully baked yet. There's a lot of new things happening in it where it's like, we don't know yet. We need to talk about it. We need to use these potential solutions and see how they work. Like Jorge yes. with the Turbo Morph stuff. Well, I know that Marco had made the Turbo Morph plugin yes. for it yes. a long time ago, but using it and seeing like other interesting problems that Idiomorph solves better is like people need to go experiment with those things and see how does it work in the real world? What are our issues? And that's I think the
morphing thing is a good example of that because there was a lot of community work around morphing that changed this in different directions. We focused on full page refreshes. That was where we saw, do you know what? I had reservations about some of the morphing stuff. For full page refreshes where you're changing a page you're already on, it really does make sense. And I'm always so sensitive about the cognitive headspace for like, how long would it take someone to understand Turbo? And Turbo to me is already not in the correct spot. I'd actually like to see a future version of Turbo that's substantially simpler than what it is today. Some of it requires fundamental advances in web technology to get there. But I want to be constantly mindful of the fact, you know what? There's too many conceptual moving pieces. And Turbo Morph focused just on the refresh problem is one of those things where you kind of turn down the dial of what someone needs to know. As I talked about, we have Turbo Streams, we have Turbo Frames, we have Turbo Drive, and so on. Just too many conceptual moving parts. So I want to get it eventually further down, since the Turbo is a thing most people don't even need to think about as much. We're not quite there yet. So we need to try things in different directions. This is why I love seeing all those experiments that like someone goes off and go try something. And I go like, something in that I like. And then there's some things I don't like about it. And then let's find out. But part of it is also just, again, that recognition that with this project in particular, we just have an outsized investment in it and an outsized buy-in in it. And in this phase where we're still trying to exactly find what it needs to be, it's not a democracy. We're not going to vote on all of it. We're not going to vote on the direction. We never voted on the direction of Rails. I struggle to think of any major open source project where the direction of the vision and the roadmap and so on is something that people treat as a democracy. Now, that conflicts sometimes with what people feel in their heart should be like, well, the user should have. Yeah. And then we're back to a little bit of the Oracle discussion and an infamous slide, right? Not all the way, right? We can do it in moderate ways and so on, but there's some tension and we just have to wrestle and recognize that there is a tension at times between the people who built the things and the people who use the things, and that they're not one person, one vote. The person who built the things have many more votes, or sometimes they have all of the votes, and that's what it is. And if you want something different, you can try to make your argument and this is how you can change the vote. Or you can also make your own things. Let's have more open source. If you have totally different ideas about how something should be built, you should totally be running your own project. And then I think you'll find allegiance with my idea that at some point you're going to put like, yeah, I also don't want the unpaid labor thing. I also want the, if I'm the one building it, I'm going to make most of the decisions kind of thing. That that's kind of just goes with the territory.
Awesome. Well, we're out of time, so we will let you go, but thanks for joining us. This was so much fun and we're super excited about all the countless new things, and you even hinted at a couple more new things that are unannounced. So more things to be on the edge of our seat for. We're excited.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me on, and thanks for doing this kind of stuff. I mean, for me, this is a huge part of what makes the Rails ecosystem exciting, that there are people just interested enough to freaking talk about it on a regular basis, interested enough to question things and pull people up and so on. So I love the work that you guys are doing and the other podcasts in the ecosystem. It's really great to see. And there's just so much good vibes and aliveness right now. So yeah, thanks again for letting me share here.
Awesome.
Thanks, David. Good to see you.
Bye.